Good evening. This is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, where I get the chance to talk with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and rather interesting personalities. Tonight, an interview recorded live at the Carter Center with Ryan Gravel. It's always a delight to return to the Carter Center because I always have such invigorating and informative conversations here. Tonight, I'm sure, will be among those that I talk about for many, many, many months to come. All right, Ryan, hello, and thank you so much
for joining me today. Such an honor to be here with you.
Ryan Gravel was a graduate student at Georgia Tech in architecture and city planning when he submitted his graduate thesis to repurpose the unique unused freight railroad corridors around Atlanta that essentially created a loop around the core of the city, a kind of belt, if you will. This thesis grew into the Atlanta Beltline, a 22-mile pedestrian-friendly transportation greenway with new parks and trails that would eventually connect 45 Atlanta neighborhoods. A founding principal of Six Pitch, Ryan specializes include urban design, infrastructure, concept development, and public policy. He serves on the board of Atlanta Beltline Partnership. Ryan has received numerous awards for his work on the Atlanta Beltline and his focus on what is called catalyst infrastructure projects. He has been listed among the 100 most influential Georgians by Georgia Trend magazine, as well as a special award of recognition from AIA Atlanta. That's architect.
AIA is?
American Institute of
Architects. American
Institute
of Architects.
A while ago.
That's what I said. In his book, Where We Want to Live, he analyzes the cultural side of infrastructures, how it has an intimate relationship with our way of life, and how it impacts the ambiance and nature of our communities. I've been looking forward to being in conversation with Ryan Gravel here at the Cecil B. Day Chapel at the Jimmy Carter Center, which happens to be just a stone's throw, a walk away from the East Side Trail of the Beltline. Thanks again, Ryan, for being with me.
Thank you.
Before we get into your book, Where We Want to Live, let's just have a little brief recap of the Beltline story, because I'm sure that there are some here who may not know what it is, although I doubt that. But let's tell us a little bit about how this came to be and how it grew wings and was able to take off.
Sure. I was in graduate school, I was studying architecture and city planning and became really fascinated with infrastructure and the role that infrastructure plays, not only in moving people and things around a city, but as the foundation for our economy and the foundation for our social life and our culture. And I had spent a year abroad in Paris and just sort of changed the way that I saw the world. And I needed a project that would be a design project, but at a city scale. So that became the Beltline, and you know, it's all lots of folklore embedded in what it is and what it might be. But I just graduated. I intended to, graduate and get a job, which I did. And some of my coworkers at the time, we were talking about the project, and they just thought it was cool. And we started talking to people, and the more people that we talked to, the more people wanted to hear about it. And we sent out a letter, this is the summer of 2001, to everybody we could think of, the governor, the mayor, all the regional planning agencies. Got some nice letters back saying good luck with that. But got a great response from Kathy Woolard, who was on city council and chair of the transportation committee. She was frustrated with the lack of investment in public transit in the city since MARTA days, and back in the 70s and 80s. And so she was just frustrated, and this letter landed on her desk, and she thought, wow, this is something. So she called us in. We did a town hall meeting in her district, and the public fell in love with it. And then she was elected city council president. We took that conversation citywide. And I was doing 3 and 4 public meetings a week And so was she, and so it, and her staff and a handful of volunteers for 2.5 years, and we built this grassroots movement of support for this project. Lots of people in this room tonight were there and part of it. And so we got the attention. We empowered and even obligated the city leadership to do it. And that's sort of where the project came from. My own story is a little, you know, I've sort of gotten different jobs along the way to sort of be a part of it in different ways. I worked many years as a volunteer, evenings and weekends. We created a nonprofit advocacy group called Friends of the Beltline, which was later the Beltline Partnership in City Hall and now back in private practice.
Well, there are people that are walking around with what you might say are good ideas all the time, but they don't go anywhere.
Right.
You mentioned, actually, there were a couple of things that you think worked for you. Mm-hmm. One was that it was a thesis.
Yeah.
And not an actual plan. I want
right.
you to speak to that for a minute. Then I want you to talk about how it gave the community activists something to fight for instead of against.
Sure.
And the other thing I'd like for you to speak to is the sense of ownership.
Okay. I'm terrible with multiple questions, so you might have to remember. That's my downfall. The first one is
Let's
the
go
academic
ahead.
Environment. I do believe, and I think that a lot of people could trust this project, this idea, because it wasn't coming from City Hall, because it wasn't coming from developers. People could trust it, just evaluate it, whether they thought it was a good idea or not. And they and enough people did, and they fell in love with it, and it became something. So
they didn't have too many questions to
right. they weren't,
to,
they weren't,
to basically stall it, because
yeah.
there wasn't that much information
they
out there
they
about it.
Right, and they weren't questioning its sort of motives. And also, you know, students have this freedom to think of big ideas that are freed of politics and budgets and physics and things like that, you know, little pesky little problems like that. And so, and that's important because our challenges ahead are really big and we have to be able to think big about it. And I think that part of the reason people fell in love with it was because it is a big idea.
Mm-hmm. And what about that sense of ownership?
And again, I'm not the kind of person that, and if you know me, you know this, that sort of pushes my ideas on you and tries to convince you to believe them. We were just sharing ideas, and people said, "Yeah, I want to hear more about that." And the ownership that they have in it became really compelling. It was like a year and a half into it. I didn't even believe we were going to do it. I just thought we were having an interesting conversation. but I was at a public meeting that we had called to get support at the Atlanta Regional Commission. And I was standing there waiting to make a public comment on the record, and these two women in front of me were saying, "No, our project is this 22-mile loop. Our project is this." And I didn't even know who they were, you know? And so the idea that they would take ownership of it, it was crystallized in my mind. I was like, the power of the public sort of believing in it and wanting it was going to be the thing that carried it through all the hurdles of the politics and the budgets and, you know, paying for it and all that. But it's really powerful when people believe in something.
That belief in something across the board would cover those who were able to participate in the Beltline economically from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and then those that might, in a way, be pushed aside because of gentrification
right.
and other things. How were we guaranteed that there would be some equity, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's an important question, and I think that it's early yet to answer. I mean, we have a lot of work ahead of us to make sure that that's true. What I can say is that early movement that I just described, that included everybody. Everybody was at that table, of all communities of all stripes and all economic incomes. And we were working on something together that nobody, frankly, believed that we were going to be able to do. But because of people on the lower end of the economic spectrum were part of our vision and part of our group making it happen, then we're kind of accountable and obligated to them. So as big of a success as the Beltline looks like today from an economic standpoint, we can't really call it a success unless we help people. And it's the thing that actually embedded in the project a sense of accountability to affordability and equity, which is why it's one of the largest affordable housing initiatives the city's ever undertaken. It's why there's 15% of the tax increment district, the tax allocation district, will go to a trust fund to support people For affordable housing.
So that's a guarantee that there will be affordable housing available in the Beltline.
The city is obligated to, I think it's 5,600 units. And that's a big investment. It's not really enough compared to the need. So the need is much larger. And when you look ahead 20 or 30 years at how much the city of Atlanta, the urban core of the region, is going to change, it's really important that we do a lot more than that. But the Beltline is doing that. And by virtue of it being accountable to that, we're talking about it in a way that we're really not talking about it for any other infrastructure project anywhere else in this region.
Interesting. So there's a tax advantage district, or no, tax allocation district that involves.
It basically leverages property taxes to help pay for the project itself. It leverages the developer interest and the new development to pay for this great public amenity.
So what happens when it gets so popular, which it almost is on Saturdays on the East Trail here? What are we going to do when it gets to be when that becomes a traffic jam, if you will?
Sure. And if you're out there on a Saturday afternoon, it already is.
I have a daughter that goes. I was a daughter and my son-in-law, and they're out there, and I'm like, "Ooh, I'm proud of you."
Yeah. What I think that the Beltline does is it illustrates a real pent-up demand for this kind of infrastructure, this kind of way of life, these kinds of things. And the Beltline can't solve all of our problems. It can't right the wrongs of the last 60 years of city building. But it can illustrate that that we need to change the way that we do things. We need to think differently and apply those same ideas to all of our public infrastructure, including city streets. I just had a great conversation with somebody earlier today asking, that's great that the Beltline's a great place to walk, but when I get off the Beltline at Irwin Street, what a disaster the sidewalk is. And it's true. We need to upgrade the entire public realm. But what the Beltline does in that scenario, in that case, is that it elevates the conversation so that now we're talking about that as a community in a way that we probably wouldn't have, if it hadn't happened.
When did you know or believe that the Beltline would continue to grow and be a success? And I'm thinking about a redhead that you mentioned in the book.
Oh, yeah. There's this great story, and it was just a couple years ago the Eastside Trail was built. We were on it. Obviously, my family, my wife and my kids, we have lived through this whole experience. They were born during this sort of grassroots movement and all this happening. We live our lives in the middle of this. But I had taken our kids for a bike ride on the Eastside Trail, and I was, they were up ahead, ahead of me, and I was in the back taking pictures with my phone, trying not to wreck, but really, amazed by how many of you are out there enjoying the day and literally talking. I can overhear you talking about how much in love you are with Atlanta again, and you're smiling, But I got home, and I was flipping through my pictures, and this image was there, and I was like, this is the best picture I've taken in 16 years working on this project. It's not because it's a beautiful spring day and people are smiling. It's because this red-haired woman that was in front of me, and she's carrying her groceries, and in the process, she's validating everything that we always said that the project would do, that it changes the way that we live our lives. It changes, it creates a way of life that before that really wasn't that possible for most people in Atlanta.
She took the Beltline to the grocery store.
Yeah, and that was before. And now you see people with their groceries all the time on the Beltline, and the thing's not even done. The tram's not there, all the ramps and stairs aren't there. It's very much a sort of phase one construction.
I understand they've even developed an etiquette campaign because it is so crowded now.
There is an etiquette, but I think there's this beautiful kind of balance on most cases where people are sort of the joggers kind of move and the bikes. There's a flow to it that's kind of a nice little ballet there. Doesn't always work, but it's fun, right?
It is.
You're listening to In Conversation, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson, speaking with Ryan Gravel, an urban planner, designer, and author. Ryan's master's thesis at Georgia Tech was the original vision for the Atlanta Beltline project. We'll be back right after this short break.
We'll be right back.
This is Valerie Jackson, back in conversation, this evening with Ryan Gravel, a visionary urban planner whose master's thesis became what is today the Atlanta Beltline Project. I spoke with Ryan at the Carter Center, where we recorded our interview before a live audience. Let's rejoin that conversation.
Where We Want to Live is the book that Ryan Gravel has written. Basically, it's kind of like a discussion of cars versus people, in a way. You talk about sprawl and what's wrong with sprawl and how do we stop it. Let's speak to that for a moment.
Well, actually, one of the big points of the book, and I know this sounds crazy to most people who are sort of dyed-in-the-wool urbanists, but you know, I don't think that there's necessarily anything wrong with sprawl. The problem with sprawl is that it has all kinds of negative outcomes to our health and our economy and all those things, and we couldn't have predicted it, but we see them very clearly now, and it's changing the way that we live, even that alone. The problem isn't sprawl itself, because lots of people live there and they enjoy it quite a lot. It's just that the problem is just that we shouldn't be subsidizing something that's not really in our collective best interest. If it increases our cost of healthcare and our cost mm-hmm. of living, if it creates new challenges for our economy, we need to stop subsidizing it, and we need to create the foundation for some other way of life, something else. And you know, the world is changing. You mentioned cars. This is not anti-car at all, actually. Our relationship with cars is changing a lot, though, with automation and car sharing, and the future looks very different. And the point is that we should be thoughtful about what kind of infrastructure we're building so that we achieve the kind of lifestyle goals that we want in the context of the reality, which is a really dramatically changing regional environment where It's not like when we were building sprawl originally in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and all the growth was sort of moving out, and it needed the cars to make that happen. Today, people are moving back into the city, and those cars just don't fit in the city, and we have to find different ways to do things.
How does one do this?
That's a great question, but it's like the Beltline, but on a much larger scale. It is a cultural momentum, and we're not waiting for Congress or City Hall to tell us what to do. We are collectively voting for different people. We are voting with our feet of where we choose to live and work, and the impact of that over a long period of time is going to be pretty dramatic.
Public policy, though, you mentioned Congress and things like that, but public policy is a very vital part of that effort without it, you know, nothing, the roads don't get built and so forth.
Right.
So what role did public policy play when you were working in the Beltline and you were trying to get the neighborhoods together and so forth?
Well, you know, the communities where the Beltline is geographically in the city of Atlanta, the city of Atlanta generally, the policies were changing already to be conducive to the kind of answer that we were looking for. The changes in the city were already moving toward more walkable, more urban, looking for transit options, and so there was a sort of political environment that was already welcoming to these ideas. Whereas regionally, it's a different kind of story.
The NPU, I think, probably had a lot to do with that neighborhood planning unit.
Sure, and I'm glad you bring that up because I learned so much about this story, my own story, as I was writing this book, and things I didn't really realize. When my wife and I met and bought a house in Southwest Atlanta, we got involved in our neighborhood planning unit. I was the chair of the Land Use Committee, and she was the secretary for a couple years. We were very much involved with our community. The NPU system, though, is born in the neighborhood movement that was part of your husband's legacy, and a beautiful and really important political structure that allowed us, when this idea came to light, to have access immediately to all corners of the city, to any community we wanted to talk to. There was already a process set in place for us to do that. And everywhere I went in the city, there were people fighting really hard for their communities of all stripes, you know, and it was really empowering and uplifting and exciting. But most people had been fighting against things. And at the end of the 20th century, bad zoning, bad development, traffic, blight,
you know, all the negative aspects of the sort of 20th century urban core. And here was this idea that was about the future, and it was optimistic, and it was leveraging the change that people saw coming to their advantage so that they could become the communities that they wanted to be. And that was a sort of really important shift. And I've heard from so many people that who were involved at that time that that ability to fight for something was so empowering. And of course, the MPU system gave us the ability to do that, not on any individual neighborhood, but across the city.
You say that the story of people can be told through our infrastructures. And in your book, Where We Want to Live, most of us think about infrastructure as sewers or pipes and bridges, things like that. But you've got a different kind of perception. And as a matter of fact, you talk sometimes almost romantically about infrastructure. There's a description in your book, chapter 10, I'm glad that you picked it up, where you speak to this. Please share your definition of infrastructure as you wrote in your book.
Thank you so much. We were among a lucky cohort of students that overlapped with professors Randy Rourke, Richard Dagenhart, Doug Allen, and David Green, who pushed a pedagogical model that actively engaged students with the civic life of the metropolis. We worked on projects that could be real, and we connected with actual people in the agencies and organizations who might benefit from our work. We provided an academic laboratory for the generation of ideas that straddled that middle ground of imagination, bold enough to be worthwhile and realistic enough to be accomplished. Our lab was set at the reasonably dense center of Atlanta's otherwise spread out landscape. And while I was enamored with Rem Koolhaas, there were also other influences. One came from a reading assignment in the Journal of Architectural Education. It was written by Alyssa Rosenberg, a professor of landscape architecture at the University of Virginia. And she delivered the challenge to me very simply. Quote, "The relationship between urban functions and the natural environment has become increasingly opaque. The ancient power of water, for example, was understood through its physical presence in many forms. Wells and cisterns, street fountains, and aqueducts once occupied a significant place in organizing urban space. Now a vast system of underground pipes makes water appear magically at the turn of a faucet. Water has consequently ceased to play a meaningful role in the design of cities." I was hooked. Words like those are tonic for infrastructure geeks like me. And my obsession with the role of infrastructure in the cultural development of cities has only grown with the success of the Atlanta Beltline. When it is done right, infrastructure can even be sexy. It is seductive. It dares us to go places we might not otherwise go. It is muscular. It shoulders the underlying weight of our social life and economy. It is brilliant. It stimulates us to express ourselves through art and literature, to start a new business, or to invent some new technology. More potently, however, it is sensual. Infrastructure forms the physical and sensory space in which we live our lives. In a role similar to that of nature, the public realm made up of infrastructure can have a warmth, breath, scent, and glimmer that combines to create suitable conditions for humans like you and me to catch each other's eye, fall in love, share a first kiss, comfort a friend, or empathize with our neighbors by being present, even anonymously, in the routine of their everyday lives. Infrastructure gets us home in time for dinner, lights our way on a romantic stroll, and draws our bath for a quiet evening at home without the kids. Of course, infrastructure can also turn cold. It can limit our ability to do those things. If we want it to, infrastructure can almost ensure a dull and unproductive condition for living. The reason we so seldom think of infrastructure as sexy today is because we have value engineered all the sex out of it. Not your average definition.
Speaking of definitions, define catalyst infrastructure. Exactly what is that?
Sure. The idea with catalyst infrastructure is that infrastructure shapes our worldview. It shapes the way that we see the world. I grew up in Chamblee. I grew up on I-285, basically between Buford Highway and Perimeter Mall. It shaped my worldview. It built what my expectations were for the world. And our view of the world also shapes the infrastructure that we build. It shapes what we do, what we vote for, what we want, and what we pay for. And so the idea with catalyst infrastructure is these new infrastructures that are being built that change people's perceptions, they change people's expectations for what they want out of their lives. And what's fascinating to me about the Atlanta Beltline project is not just that that's working here and that it's doing it, but that it's part of a much larger story. And the book gets into some detail about projects that are happening all over the world.
Let's talk about a few of those.
Sure. So I get to travel a lot and share our story, and a lot of other cities want to hear what it is that we're doing. And everywhere I go, you know, I'm telling my story, but they're telling me stories about what they're doing. They're repurposing old railroads, degraded waterways, obsolete roadways, and people at a community level, in most cases, really clamoring to reinvent these spaces for something new. And it's not the same combination of transit or trail, or parks or economic development or community stabilization or art or health or any number of things that the Atlanta Beltline is, some different combination for some different purpose. But they're reclaiming this infrastructure, and it's doing the same thing that we're doing here. It is changing not only the physical form of the city, it's changing the way that we think about the city and what our expectations are for living here. And so the best example that I'm just really enamored with and just sort of smitten with it, if I can be in love with infrastructure, is the Los Angeles River.
Who even knew Los Angeles had a river? Did you know?
Except,
I didn't.
Yeah, except every post-apocalyptic movie coming out of Hollywood. Or Greece, depending on your generation. It's beautiful in its current condition, in my opinion, but there's been a grassroots movement since the 80s to make it into some life-affirming infrastructure. And think about this. In the 1930s, the Army Corps of Engineers channelized the LA River. 80% of the river, of the 51-mile river, was lined with concrete. But just a couple years ago, the same Army Corps of Engineers just agreed to a $1 billion restoration of one small section of the Glendale Narrows. The shift is not just the physical transformation of the river. The shift is the cultural change, not only in the communities, but in the governance structures, the business models, everything that's sort of built around that. And so these projects play this catalyst role of not only changing the immediate environment and providing very clear, very straightforward kind of benefits to those communities, but really playing a larger role in sort of the civic identity and changing what people's expectations are. There's projects in the bayous in Houston, are stunning. The drainage ditches, which were streamlined again by the Army Corps of Engineers, and now being re-meandered with new, they got rid of all the pesky wildlife and trees and stuff, but now they're sort of putting that back together and repurposing it for a more urban future, something different. It's not going to be this wild place again, but it has a similar story.
So does that mean that we are now creating infrastructures that are, from the beginning, beautiful and involved in the neighborhoods?
There's one of the aspects of these projects is that they're inherently community-driven. That's where they're coming from, that set cultural momentum. But I think it's, to be fair, it's important to understand that, the highways and the infrastructure that created sprawl was also beautiful, and in some cases still is. It came from a cultural momentum. It was millions of people over an extended period of time making the best decisions that they could for their families. It was a similar kind of cultural momentum. It wasn't available to everyone at the time. It was limited to who would benefit, especially in those first waves of change. But nobody really imagined where it was going or where we were going. So the community orientation of this current sort of new generation of infrastructure is one really important aspect is that it is community driven. It is inherently diverse in its sort of perspective and inclusion in terms of equity and those things. So it's important that we not only invest in those outcomes, but also that we maintain that dialogue to make sure that we get the best outcome.
We'll be back after this short break and continue our conversation with Ryan Gravel, urban planner, designer, and author of Where We Want to Live. Welcome back. This is your host, Valerie Jackson. Tonight I bring you a conversation we recorded at the Carter Center's Cecil B. Day Chapel. I talked with Ryan Gravel, author of Where We Want to Live, Reclaiming Infrastructure for a New Generation of Cities. Let's rejoin that interview.
How does the U.S. compare with other parts of the world in developing pedestrian and cycling trails between communities?
We are behind some and ahead of others. you know, this repurposing, this sort of catalyst infrastructure idea is global for sure. I think that it's our time is now in the United States and Canada too. A lot of these things are happening right now. Some of the rest of the world are watching us on that. Singapore, I was there a year ago. They know more about the Atlanta Beltline than most people in this room.
Really?
And they see it as their primary model for what they're doing. Not because they have a 15-mile abandoned railroad that goes across their whole country island. And it's not the physical transformation of the corridor that they see as the model, although that's part of it. It's really the community orientation. They're thinking about how they can make this into an infrastructure that supports the communities along the way. And to me, that's like the coolest thing.
many cities, though, are suffering from stagnation, and the issue of mass transit and urban development is a serious one. You noted that MARTA is the backbone to any future transit development in Atlanta. Yet a bill recently to put MARTA expansion on the ballot failed to pass, and so we're not going to be able to vote on whether we can extend or expand MARTA. If you were to design the expansion of MARTA, MARTA, do you have any idea what you would do?
I would definitely start with communities that want it.
The problem is some of them don't know that they want it. They need it, but they don't even know it.
No, I agree with you. Actually, I think that a lot of communities, they're not there yet. But they will be. And I think for me, the perspective is we need to help everybody get to this table as fast as possible. And it's only because we're in the beginning of the shift, and if you're attuned to the indicators of the shift, you see it very clearly, and if you're not, you might be oblivious. But if you look at the difference between Cumberland Galleria, for example, and Perimeter Center, the changes that are happening right now are very different. And if you were a big corporate entity like State Farm or Mercedes, for example, and you want a suburban environment for your office, you're going to go to Perimeter Center because they have MARTA, and that's why. And that's very clearly and very documented by those very corporations as to why. They may not use it, but some of their people who work there will, and they'll be able to attract talent there that other areas won't be able to have. And especially when you look ahead at the future of traffic in this region, because we're basically not doing anything about it, and I know that we are to some level, but not on the magnitude that we should or need to. You know, the areas that don't have transit are going to be increasingly locked into traffic jams. At some point, there's really just not that much more we can do.
You mentioned four positions that might help kickstart a dialogue for new, improved communities. The first is the need to experiment with ideas.
Yes.
Talk about that a minute. What's guerrilla gardening? That's one of them that you mentioned.
Yeah, I wanted to say that, you know, this catalyst infrastructure idea is one piece of this larger momentum, and there's all kinds of other things happening in sort of in innovation in food and urban agriculture and all kinds of things. And guerrilla gardening is where people literally just go out and throw up a garden in some wasted piece of land
vacant
and start growing food. Yeah, vacant lots, old railroads, whatever. So that's kind of exciting. But the idea of experimentation is important because, you know, you think of the interstate highway system as, for example, like it just spontaneously appeared overnight, but it didn't. It came as in fits and starts through experimentation over decades. And that's what's happening here with these new infrastructures. And it's important that we test ideas, that we go and look at other projects and see what other cities are doing. I'm really excited. In June, I get to go. The folks who are at the behind the High Line have called together a meeting of these projects. So I'm going to go up there on behalf of the Beltline. Yeah, and the LA River people are going to be there, and a bunch of us, and we're going to talk together about what this might mean, because it's going to shape all kinds of things if this really continues forward.
Your second suggestion was the need to develop a political structure for change.
Yeah.
What would that take, and what kind of structure are you talking about?
The NPU system, for example. The NPUs were the structure, the political structure that the city of Atlanta had access to. But when I go and talk to these other places, Miami comes to mind. There's a project called The Underline, and they don't have that political structure for getting into the community level and talking about creating this kind of grassroots momentum around that idea. It doesn't mean that they can't do it. They are, but it's a lot more work. And if we want to have a more sizable change, then we need a structure to support that. So how you do that at a regional level is different from what the city of Atlanta can do through NPUs. And I don't proclaim to have that answer, but I think it's important that we start to put it together.
And the need to stop sprawl.
I think that this is a really important point, not only for cities, which obviously would benefit from stopping the sort of investments in that we make, millions and billions of dollars investment in continuing this sort of legacy of sprawl. I also think it's important to see stopping sprawl as the best answer for people who live in sprawl now. It's sort of an act of self-preservation, because if you live in a community that's sort of defined by sprawl, the worst thing that you could do is sprawl more. It's just going to lock you into traffic. And the further you get locked in, the more you want to move back out. And it creates this sort of wave of destruction and decline. And so I think it would be really strategic if we stopped doing that for sprawl.
And you stop that through code enforcements and business models, new business models, or what?
Yeah, and capital improvement budgets at every level. I mean, we're making enormous investments right now in sprawl right here in Metro Atlanta. and highway lane expansions and all these things. The projects are fine, the infrastructure is fine, but only if it's followed up with policy. Because if you don't follow it up with policy about limiting the kind of growth that it inherently will create, then you're only creating more problem for yourself.
If you can't limit it, your fourth suggestion is to redirect the growth.
Right.
And so how would you...
Well, they're both. I mean, yeah, you could do one without the other, mm-hmm. but I think they go hand in hand. And that is through, instead of sprawling out more and locking people into that traffic jam, you basically just orient all the... I mean, the region of Atlanta, metropolitan Atlanta, is going to grow by 2.5 million people over the next 20 years. We're nearly 6 million now. Think about all those people. If all those people have to also drive on the roads that we have now, we're in trouble. And so if we organized most of those future people to live in environments where they could walk and bike and ride transit, that would be much more efficient financially for us in terms of infrastructure investments, but also make a lot more sense for regional traffic jams.
So as we anticipate more ride sharing, driverless cars, mm-hmm. et cetera, where do you see successful planning of multimodal pathways, or do you see any that would be able to accommodate the car along with the bike and the stroller and the mm-hmm. pedestrian? Do you ever see all of them, working together?
Sure. I think one thing that I've learned from all these other infrastructure projects, that it's less about a recipe of elements that go into this new infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's more of a way of looking at infrastructure and working on infrastructure that is inherently sort of inclusive of everyone. And so transit isn't always part of it. Trails aren't always part of it. But if we can think of a highway, for example, as something that's about more than just people driving cars, then it opens up a lot of opportunities. And I think that as we continue to get jammed up in traffic, that we will see the benefit of giving up one of those lanes for something else, for example. And that could include transit, for example. And I think that at some point we'll get to that, but it's going to be maybe a while.
I want to just say this because I think it's important relative to the Beltline, and we've talked about several things, but the International Real Estate Federation named the Atlanta Beltline, quote, the best environmental rehabilitation project in the world.
I want to add. I see Camilla Warren here from EPA, and I think EPA federal agency gave us their Smart Growth Project of the Year in 2013, not just because it cleans up it attracts the private market, the private sector to clean up a bunch of contaminated industrial sites in cities, or attract where that's not possible still financially attracts the. Gets those agencies involved to solve the problem, but then uses that land for real significant community benefit. And the best example that I can come up with is the Lantern Parade. I mean, this is this...
The Lantern Parade,
yeah.
Yes.
I mean, we're taking this old infrastructure, this abandoned industrial contaminated land, and we're turning it into this amazing infrastructure for something that wouldn't have happened otherwise, something that somebody... out of the blue came up with some crazy idea to have a lantern, a parade that you walk in and with your homemade lanterns and your family. And they went from 200 people to 60,000 people in just a handful of years. And I mean, it's when I tell that story in Toronto or LA or wherever I go, they are blown away by it.
You suggest finally that in Where to Live, that the Beltline can play a significant role in healing the South. What did you mean by that?
Well, and I believe that. I think that we have to do it very intentionally and consciously in order to achieve that goal. But there is a certain kind of beauty that beyond all these other projects, that the Beltline as a loop, people have always sort of connected with that, and that it ties these communities together in ways that they really weren't before. Because the freight railroad never operated that way, but we're all in the same boat, and that grassroots movement was built by communities who there really wasn't much us and them back then, and it was very collective, and then you're taking this railroad that's a barrier, literally a barrier between neighborhoods that historically were one side of the tracks and the other side of the tracks, differentiated socioeconomically and every other way. So you're taking this barrier and you're transforming it into this common meeting ground. And there's something really powerful about that, that you're connecting neighborhoods that are not only down the track from each other, but across the track from each other. And when you go out there and you see the sort of breadth of humanity sort of out there on the East Side Trail and everywhere else, it's really rewarding to see. And I think that bringing people together to a table to talk about our differences and our challenges ahead is so important. It's a legacy that Atlanta already has, and it's something that we can continue to build on and sort of take to the next level.
Hopefully. Is there one thing that you're most excited about that the Beltline has yet to create?
Oh, wow. There is, but I don't know what it is. I mean, really, who would have thought that Chantel Ritter would come up with this idea for the Lantern Parade? And so what fascinates me is what people do with it. You know, because to me, I'm the wonky infrastructure guy, right? I'm interested in creating this infrastructure that supports your way of life, but I don't know what you're going to do with it. And I don't, for example, play my violin tugging my dog in the back of a cooler. But you've seen her out there, and she does it, and she's awesome. And I'm afraid to meet her because I don't want to embarrass myself. But I think that she is amazing, and she gives a life to this. She illustrates the idea that whether it's her or the redhaired woman with the groceries, that people make it their own, and they make it what they want. And that's the best kind of city to live in.
And the Beltline has spawned new businesses that have been developed in what used to be depressed areas. It's a fascinating place to be, to walk, to experience, and I'm looking forward. Well, I certainly personally want to thank you, Ryan, for your visionary efforts for sticking with this, for having the idea in the first place, and working for, how many years now?
16.
Ooh.
Way to go. It's lightning speed for city planners. That's really fast.
And on that note,
yeah.
I think we have time for one or two questions from the audience.
We'll recognize Councilmember Hall.
Thank you. Thank you for a great panel. It was excellent, y'all. Kwanzaa Hall, Atlanta City Council. I just want to say, first, thank you for the gift to the city. It's a great legacy that we have to cherish. And I just wanted to find out what you think we really need to do as we look forward to make sure that the intent truly does live up to what you expected from the start.
Thank you. I think that there are two really key things that are part of it, and Atlanta Beltline Inc. and the Beltline Partnership and everybody are working on now, but it would be really helpful, and it more and more helpful the more people vocalize it and say it. And those are, transit has to be a part of this project, and we need to be investing in it sooner rather than later. And the question of who benefits and where affordability is very much also connected to that other point of transit, but we need to make sure that the people who made this project happen and come to life are get to stay and enjoy its benefits.
Hi, Ryan. Hey. Bill Bowling. I'm an attorney. Hi, Valerie. I moved here 10 years ago, and I watched all this grow up. My law office is now on the Beltline, as is my home, and so I pedaled my bicycle here and managed to miss the violin lady with the dog during the ballet. Ryan, what do you see as the next two or three big ideas that for Atlanta that are maybe as big or bigger than the Beltline that are out there that could be the next catalyst infrastructure for the city?
Thank you. Actually, I happen to be working on two of them. One is for the Chattahoochee River, but for this organization called Go River, as they say in LA. I'm a big believer in it. This is for a group called Chattahoochee Now. They're looking at the river from Cumberland Galleria downstream for 50 miles. And, you know, most of the river that you can go to is in Sandy Springs or Roswell. It's beautiful. There's a ton of work that's been done there that we're all sort of indebted to. But the river is much closer, and there are places, there's just nowhere to go. And so this group is looking at creating new access points and new ways to connect to the river. We're just delivering the vision for that, which is a 5,000-acre working park that includes farms and forests and parks along the river, sort of a giant green lung for the region. Which would support the sort of idea of Atlanta being this sort of adventurous kind of corridor. The other is called the Atlanta City Design. It's with Mayor Reed, hired Commissioner Tim Keene in the Department of Planning and Community Development last summer. And he got me involved with this idea that, hey, if we're gonna grow by the city of Atlanta, grow by 1 million people in the next 20 years, maybe we should be thoughtful about that in all the infrastructure that we have. So making sure that we identify and then protect the things that make Atlanta special so that as we grow, we become more of what Atlanta is, not some place that we don't recognize or like anymore.
Authenticity is a big point that you make, that we deal with authenticity when we're recreating these infrastructures.
Right. People really want, I want to live somewhere that's special. You know, I want it somewhere, and you don't have to live in the most special place in the world, but you do want to kind of you want to be connected to some other larger kind of story.
Hello, Ryan. My name is Amber Johnson. I'm a student and undergraduate research assistant at Georgia Tech, doing work on sidewalks.
Awesome. And,
I love sidewalks, and I love the Beltline. So my biggest concern, I really do love walking the Beltline, but I also walk to school.
Right.
And one of the things I noticed from walking to school and doing research with Dr. Ginsler at Georgia Tech is that a lot of Atlanta sidewalks are broken.
Yes.
So how do we make Atlanta connective and like increase that connectivity with the Beltline, and we're investing in the Beltline and it's super awesome and it's new.
Yep.
But what about those old sidewalks that feed into it?
Right.
And what do you think the city of Atlanta should do about it?
Why are you looking at me?
Yeah. Well, I think I had a very similar conversation just yesterday, and you know, the Beltline is the big shiny new thing, but you know, a lot of the sidewalks are broken and we need to fix them. What the Beltline can, how the Beltline can help is that it is elevating the conversation, the dialogue around the pedestrian realm. It is dumping literally hundreds of thousands of people out onto Irwin Street, for example, and Monroe, where tragically a young woman just lost her life the other day. It's really important that we elevate this conversation and make sure that we do it. Now, to be fair, it's going to cost money to do it. Now, there are ways to do that. There are studies that show where that money can come from, but we have to get people loud about it and vocal, and it'll change. If we speak what we want and we define where it is that we want to live, it will happen. But Atlanta is unique in terms of sidewalks. Atlanta is uniquely underperforming, let's say. I mean, in Detroit, you can walk down the street and the sidewalk is, you know, the gorgeous. And they don't have, and so how do they do that if we have this great economy? We have all of our resources and we have all of this energy, and they have a lot of more challenges than we do. They're doing innovative stuff. I love Detroit. But there's something going on with us and our sidewalks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining us this evening. We appreciate it very much. This is Valerie Jackson in conversation with Ryan Gravel.
Thank you for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our audio archive online at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for this program is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Lois Reitzis and Dave Barrowswain. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in conversation. Good night.